The last Mennonites in Poland fled for their lives at the end of World War II. Those of my family's Prussian ancestors left much earlier, in 1789 and soon thereafter. Now we turn to their Russian story. There's an interesting story about that decision to move to Russia, but I won't go into that today. Some of you will recall that Catherine the Great in Russia was born in Prussia and did not forget her homeland. While she reigned in Russia in the 18th century, she went to Prussia and Germany to invite Mennonites, Lutherans, and Catholics to settle in Russia on the land taken from the Kurds and the Turks in the recent war. Two Mennonite scouts from Prussia went to see the promised land. They were Heppner and Bart, and returned to tell their countrymen of the agreement they made with the Russian government. There was good land in the steppes of the Ukraine to be had, and military exemption and other privileges were promised. In turn, the Mennonite colonists were forbidden to proselyte the Russian Orthodox Church members. They would live in colonies, separate from the Russians, and control their own villages, churches, and schools. In these colonies, Mennonites could worship freely. They could keep their German language. Emigration from Prussia began in 1789. The first colony, called Khortitsa, was next to the Dnieper River. All my known ancestors settled in this area. Khortitsa was close to the city of Zaporozhye, today a large Ukrainian city. The second colony was established in 1804 and called Molochna. Each of these colonies consisted of several dozen villages where immigrants lived close together, like in a small town with a field being away from the housing area. Here again, the Mennonite settlers prospered, some becoming quite wealthy. Manufacturing as well as agriculture was well advanced. After graduating from Mennonite high schools, some students attended university in faraway St. Petersburg at institutions in various European countries, including my uncle, my mother's brother. He studied in tell me, Ray. Pardon? Okay. Manufacturing as well as agriculture was well advanced. Okay. St. Petersburg and at institutions in various, pardon? Yeah. Okay, Ray and I visited many of the villages in both Khortitsa and Molochna, where we toured the Ukraine, no longer a part of Russia, in 1996. Although in 1789, Mother Russia did not give them the fertile land that they had been promised them in the Kherson area near the Black Sea. This was really a good area, and the land in the old colony was inferior. The Mennonites prospered during the approximately 150 years they occupied the land. Village life had been safe and secure, provided a church and school in German. Wholesome family life, freedom of religion, a social life, abundant fruit and vegetables, and good crops. Their village had white picket fences along the street, guarding the fruit trees and the abundant gardens. In their connected house and barns, under their one roof, they felt protected from harm and danger. My parents were born approximately a century after the immigrants arrived. That was in 1885 and 1888. They weren't born in this village, though. By this time, the colonies had outgrown the available farmland where my parents were born and looked for more land. In 1888, a wealthy Russian landholder sold thousands of hectares to the Mennonites. This location was 254 kilometers, mostly east and a little north of the old colony. Hearsay is that his name was Ignatov. So they named their daughter colony Ignatov. He became a Canadian businessman. The soil was black and stone-free. The climate was pleasant. Grandfather Unger moved his family of six to this would-be earthly Eden. My mother was a year old. My father's family would migrate from Khartitsa to this village in Ignatov when he was a young man. The village itself was named Grigoryevka. Those years of our parents and grandparents were called the Golden Era. It was not until Nicholas II was forced by the revolutionaries to abdicate the throne in 1917 that my parents and their people felt their security being threatened. After all, Grigoryevka was just a little dot on the map of the Russian Empire, isolated and far away from the seats of power. However, 18,000 of their fellow believers, Mennonites from their original colonies and other colonies, daughter colonies, saw the writing on the wall and immigrated to North America already in 1874 to 1875. I'm going to take the liberty of asking those whose forefathers came in that in those migrations, stand up, please. Yes, thank you very much. Their freedoms were threatened, and the government could no longer be trusted to keep their promises. For example, German could no longer be the language used in Mennonite schools. Before long, military exemption would be denied. However, in Grigoryevka, where my parents lived, the emigration did not begin until the mid-20s. This time, in the second exodus, 25,000 migrated to the United States, Canada, and South America. There were many uncertainties for those who stayed behind after the 1870s migration. Now, in addition to fear of losing their privileges, like freedom of religion and exemption from the military, there were many uprisings that portended a bigger revolution coming. Some were hopeful and decided to wait out the Russian Revolution, but others were afraid. My grandmother Clausen had been widowed three times, and my father was operating her farm. This was not a way to get rich, but it was a good life until the revolution. Grandma died of natural causes in 1924, a year before our parents left Russia. She was buried in Grigoryevka, the village that they lived. My maternal parents were comfortable, but a daughter and her husband died during the flu epidemic, leaving five orphan children. My parents grieved the death of their oldest two children in 1915. They had two childhood communicable diseases at the same time. They were three and one, and left my parents childless. My mother still grieved their death 10 years later, but after living in Saskatchewan for some years, she plainly said, "They are better off dead." Grandpa Unger had the means with which to help his children emigrate. He paid their fare to Canada. However, two of his children did not make it to Canada. One was arrested by the Soviet police on false charges, as were many other innocent Mennonites and Russian citizens, and was imprisoned in Siberia. He later lived in Kyrgyz, near the northwest corner of China. Another one went to Paraguay because she had trachoma of the eyes and Canada would not accept her. And one orphan niece also remained in Russia with aunts on the other side of the family. And thus the family was torn between three continents, never to see each other again. My parents and their five children had legitimate visas and in 1925 took the train to Riga, Latvia, then on to Southampton, England, where they boarded the ship Minnedosa, and after 4 weeks arrived safely in Quebec Harbor. An unknown world of smoky black chimneys defined the horizon. Mother remembered that. They knew not a word of English, feeling like foreigners had begun in England, where they had to be examined by physicians to pass a health inspection required for immigration. Dad recalled that he had been looking for the dining room, and he had said to the steward, Essen, Essen. Who knows what Essen is? The Brit showed him the bathroom. That was only the beginning of the orientation. Essen means eating, eating. Where do we eat? In Canada, they took a long train ride to Steinbach, Manitoba, where Dad's half-brother awaited him. He was a Friesen, and his family, and Jerry Friesen reminds me of him. He looks like him. His brother could not accommodate them because his family had arrived recently also. A Reimer family in the area accepted them in their home. Mrs. Reimer had recently delivered a baby and needed household help. They had come in the earlier migration. My mother's baby had celebrated his first birthday on the ship, and she had three daughters aged 2 to 8 and a 10-year-old son. They were Gerhard, they're all German names, Agneta, Anna, Helena, and Heinrich. In Canada, they became George, Nettie, Annie, Lena, and Henry. So my mother had her hands full. She seldom complained about the work, but talked about the things that were entirely new to immigrants. She and Dad had been in the Reimer cellar and saw the jars of canned peaches. They had never seen peaches and were unfamiliar with canning. What is this, they wondered. Like Adam and Eve, they were curious. To figure out how to open a jar was a challenge, but they got it open and took out half, only one half a peach, and closed the jar, placing it safely back on the shelf. Mother chuckled as she told the story later because she knew the peaches would have spoiled, and she did learn to can. And one night they saw the work of God in those northern skies. The northern sky was full of bright and moving lights. What kind of signal was God trying to give them? They had already experienced enough drama on the other side of the Atlantic. They soon learned about Canada's beautiful and innocent northern lights. I think they spent only the winter in Manitoba, only one winter in Manitoba, before they followed Dad's sister and her family to Blumenort, Saskatchewan. Does anybody know where that is? Swift Current, Saskatchewan, maybe? Okay. In 1926, some shacks in southern Saskatchewan were vacated by conservative Mennonites who left Canada to go to Mexico, where they could have their own school instead of the English schools in Canada, which were compulsory. Doesn't that sound familiar? I'm not sure it was one of those empty shacks that they lived in, but it is likely. It had two rooms. How they gathered, one bed, chairs, and table, I don't know. My Dad knew farming as the only way of making a living. He needed land, implements, a house, and a barn, and animals, and he had nothing. And Mother needed a table, chairs, beds, bedding, a stove, sewing machine, dishes, and all that goes with the beginning all over. Dad began to earn a living by working for farmers, and not all of them knew German. Although he was in trouble when he was helping Again, he was in trouble when he was helping a farmer catch a horse in a pasture. The farmer said, "Catch him, catch him." And he did, but the farmer still kept saying, "Catch him." So thinking he misunderstood, Dad let the horse go. Then Dad heard some language from the farmer that was unforgettable, but he never forgot the meaning of catch him. I was 2 when Dad bought his first farm about 50 miles from his sister and his family. You will read in the book about his loan and the burden of the debt and how it was paid off. You will read, this was the autumn of 1929, the year of the stock market crash, and soon became the decade-long Great Depression. And it was the beginning of the long years of drought. What Dad didn't know was that this farm was in the middle of the Palliser Triangle, where a glacier had melted eons ago, and the dry land was dry and rocky. It was full of stones. Here in this place, I have my earliest memories. They were happy memories. I was too young to understand the agony of the poverty that was unknown even to my parents until this time. It was in Rush Lake, Saskatchewan, that we lived in the house, which became the subtitle of my book. I will come back to that later. As long as I remember, I played with my younger sister, Justine, who was born in the spring of the first year we lived on that farm. When she was older, Justine and I played endlessly with paper dolls cut out of the Eaton's catalog, or with hairless dolls pretending they were mothers and having meals with their toy dishes. I also remember how my brother sought me to play with him. His play had to do with playing on the binder, running old rubber tires down the hill, climbing onto the granary roof and throwing rocks, and hiding in the barn to watch a chicken lay her egg. Our town was Rush Lake. Rush Lake was a little farm town with two streets that made an L. It had two country stores, a small hotel, a country doctor, a United Church of Canada, a post office, and a brick school where all 12 grades were taught by two teachers. It was also where our cousins live, the Harms. Their parents owned the store. We were literally their country cousins. Our world consisted of that little town and our 160-acre farm two miles away from town. If our farm had a water-producing well, we may have lived happily ever after. The farmer before us had attempted to dig a well without reaching water. His name was Friesen. Dad began to build the dry earth to a depth of about 50 feet, we estimate. Not a drop of water came from that well in the 8 years we lived at Rush Lake. We did have a dugout, which we called the slough, that collected snow water in winter for the animals, but Dad hauled water, all our water, from other farms with horses and wagons for 8 years. In freezing cold, he took the horses and the sleigh 2 miles and filled all his three barrels, one by one, with a bucket. It rarely rained. He really had a holiday when it rained. Some years, Dad harvested some grain. I remember it because my brother and I played in the bin, and when Dad found out we had played in the bin, we were told never to do that again because the walls of the bin would break and the precious grain would be wasted.